Coming up on this episode of Inside Pop,
we speak with a premier costume designer who has worked on Black Klansman and the brand new season of the Netflix series, She's Gotta Have It.
Then we chat about the brilliance of Phoebe Waller-Bridge, from Fleabag to Killing Eve.
All of that, and of course, the big sell, it's all happening right now on Inside Pop.
Hey y'all, I'm Amita Patel.
And I'm Sean David Johnson, and this is Inside Pop. We are your deep dive inside the world of pop culture.
One quick note, if you are an Apple Podcast or iTunes user, please head over there to subscribe, give us a little rating, and if you have some time, write a little review of our show. We totally appreciate it, and it helps more people find this podcast. Thanks in advance.
And there was something wonky going on with our iTunes page. So if you have left a review in the past couple of years, actually, your review didn't go through. So I don't know what happened. But if you would do us a kindness and actually go back and leave us a review and rating, we'd appreciate it.
And we'll give you a shout out for doing it twice.
Oh, yeah. Most definitely. All right, let's start the show. We are going to talk about someone we didn't even know she existed a couple of years ago, and she's turned into one of our absolute favorite television creators. We're talking about Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who first came into our lives with the first season of Fleabag, a really amazing comedy drama about a dysfunctional woman, single, growing up, living her life in England. And it's about so much more than that. And it was really just, I think, the funniest, smartest show we saw that year. And we have been impatiently waiting. And finally, Fleabag Season 2 has hit the States. I know our friends in the UK had a chance to watch it a couple of months ago, and I was quite jealous.
Oh, yeah. And this actually, I have to thank you, Mr. Johnson, because you big sold this to me way back when, and I enjoyed it in the big sell. And then I think I only watched like two or three episodes, and then I kind of fell out of it and started watching other things. And I finally got back to finishing this first season and loving it, and was chomping at the bit for season two. And I have finished it. You have not. But all of the reviews and all of the articles I've read has said it is a perfect season, and I have to agree.
I like that word, perfect. It's great. I mean, and it's so, I mean, we've talked a lot about second seasons, and well, speaking of second seasons, as if starring and creating one amazing show was not enough, Phoebe Waller-Bridge is also one of the executive producers of Killing Eve, which also just concluded its second season. I have not seen the finale. So we're going to talk about these shows without spoiling the ending. So for those of you who are like me, it's a safe space. So,
and for those of you who are like me, who've seen both and finished both, DM me and we'll talk about it.
And I think one of the things that we want to get into is basically the worlds that she creates, right? These worlds in Fleabag, the world of Fleabag, the world of Killing Eve, and how they're really rich, weird, strange, maybe not realistic worlds, but that feel realistic in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, if we want to start with Killing Eve, I think it doesn't feel super realistic that this crazy assassin, you know, who's got this amazing wardrobe, and Sandra Oh is this complex detective who has this psychological attraction and battle at the same time with this serial killer. I think that's the one way to kind of set up the show without giving too much away. And it's so interesting, and you peel off something else in every episode between all of the characters, but mainly between the two main characters, Villanelle and Eve. And I fell in love with it when it first came out last year, and they just always up the ante every episode. They really know how to create that suspense and keep you guessing. And I love that about the series.
I was nervous about season two because I thought, wow, they did so much, and so much of the season led up to the two of them finally meeting. What could they possibly do to keep it interesting in the second season? And I think they, for the most part, I think they've succeeded. I think that they found a way to get these two characters together and for it to always be interesting, if not always as dangerous as it first felt. So I think maybe the lack of danger was replaced by just a really strange, interesting, compelling dynamic between those two. And I think, you know, and they go deeper. I think, you know, Eve is, I don't know, would you call her an anti-hero?
Yeah, I think in season one, she started out as a hero, but then transformed. And mm-hmm. I think in season two, she's a full-on anti-hero.
She's doing some bad things.
She is.
I hope that, I think the actress who plays Villanelle is amazing. She has such a great sense of timing. Obviously, she does great accents, and she just does really interesting things with that sociopathic character. She's great. I hope she gets a nomination this year.
I hope so, too. She actually won the BAFTA for this role recently and gave us really charming and wonderful speech. You can look it up online. I love her so much, and I do know Sandra Oh is fantastic in this role, but I do feel like Jodie Comer, who plays Villanelle, is just as equally as talented and needs more recognition for all of the characters she plays, because she does like transform into different characters, like you said, with different accents, and that's just incredible what she does on screen.
I think one thing that worked for me for the second season of Killing Eve is really just to, I mean, you have to change it up, right? It has to be interesting. So in that first half of the season, you know, Villanelle was the villain. She was the bad guy. She was the victim, at least in the first, three episodes, right? Remember, she was injured. Mm-hmm. She somehow happened upon this guy in the grocery store and ended up being his prisoner. And I thought that was really interesting, because all of a sudden you're fearing for her safety, and I would have never thought that would have happened. So I think those choices were really interesting, to turn Villanelle into a victim for a time, right? To turn Eve into someone who started out, you know, very earnest, who got kind of caught up in everything, to someone who's making a lot of wrong decisions and, you know, possibly heading to become the woman for whom she works.
Yeah, a little bit. And then I think what I love is, like, I feel like Villanelle went through that first third of a season being the victim, but then the second third was then becoming the cohort,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, then, you know, we are spoiling a little bit, right? But, like, you know, they then utilize her in MI6 in a way, and it becomes, now they're working slightly together. And so it's so, again, nothing that I ever expected either, which I love that the show always just keeps you on your toes.
Always, always. And it's a world you want to return to, right? It's you know, this world of Killing Eve is really, yeah, definitely the world you want to return to. Like Fleabag, I'll segue.
Nice transition.
Thank you. So listen, I am savoring this. It's only 6 episodes, so Chris and I are only allowing ourselves to watch 1 episode a day. It's so tempting to go to that next episode because every moment is just so brilliant and good.
Yeah, and so Phoebe Waller-Bridge did this series before Killing Eve. This series she writes and stars in. She is not in Killing Eve at all. And so I think what's interesting about how she approaches this is I think there's so much more of her in it, more of her personality, and more of maybe just the voice in her head, I feel, is more in this. Maybe she's a serial killer, but let's hope not. you know, as also a single woman, there are so many moments in season one and in a lot in season two where you feel like she is reading your mind. And she's so vulnerable in so much of this season as a character that I cherished every moment of it. There's a girl I work with who mentioned she had finished the season. And when I finished the second season of Fleabag, all I did was just go back and forth with her about this moment and this moment and that moment. There is this incredible moment in a bar where one of the characters just says, being a woman, you are born with pain. And I was like, oh my, I think I actually screamed at my TV. I said, yes! There's so many yes things when you watch this second season, which is what makes it so perfect.
Yeah, the show's hysterical, but it's a funny show with really damaged, vulnerable characters. You know, Fleabag, and I love mm-hmm. that's her name. That's the only name we know her by, Fleabag.
I know.
Played by Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She's so damaged. Her sister is incredibly damaged. It's played yes. for laughs, but there's this undercurrent of pain, right? So you feel for her, you root for her, you laugh at her with her.
Mm-hmm.
And you're really laughing with her too, because she's constantly breaking the fourth wall, winking at the audience, looking at the audience. And this season, it's really interesting because it's become more than just a device. There's this intrusion that we're making that feels almost tangible, right?
Oh my God,
like,
yeah.
There's a character who, after she turns to us and winks, says, what were you just doing there? And it's a scary something that happens in Killing Eve, because all of a sudden you're like, wait, he saw us? Like, that was
yes.
my feeling. Yeah, it's interesting that she's doing that with the device. I'm assuming more will happen. I don't know. I'm only three uh-huh. episodes in. But I think that that's also really clever and creative.
It was super clever, and I didn't expect it, and I love that this character, and I don't think we're giving too much up, but this is somebody that she's attracted to, and the fact that she's able to be attracted to this person, that person sees her. I think the whole point is that he sees her
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
also sees this place that she goes to, which is, when you watch the show, the place she goes to is looking at camera, breaking that fourth wall. It's us. And he sees that she drifts, that she goes away somewhere, and he calls her out on it. And I think that was so brilliant that they did that in this season, because it peels off that other layer of vulnerability. And then she's thrown off.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, what
mm-hmm.
are you talking about? You know that I'm making asides to somebody that doesn't exist.
Right, right.
You know, and so I think that's what's, that added this extra layer to the show that I love. I have some unfortunate news, Sean. Phoebe Waller-Bridge has said that she's leaving Fleabag as is, two seasons. You haven't finished it.
Right.
But, ooh, it's tough.
Well, you know, I actually say that's good news, because if she gave us two really brilliant, perfect seasons, I don't want a third one that's just okay. So more TV shows should do this. We're mm-hmm. not mentioned.
I knew that you would enjoy
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I'm glad. Good.
I will say mm-hmm. I just love what she does with this character so much. I was so torn when I read it, because I finished watching and it was such a perfect season with an extremely perfect ending.
Oh, good.
And it feels like it ended. And it's it. And it's the end, and there's nothing else after it. But because I love what she did so much, and I love what she put all of the characters through, I want more. But she left it so well that I get it. And it's so hard not to discuss details with you.
Of course she's doing that, but I think that's so good. I really wish that, I think it's happening more, you know, as showrunners become more powerful, as the fan's voice becomes louder, and as TV becomes more, you know, more cinematic, I think that people who are able to write towards endings and end the series when they want to end it, I think there's obviously more and more and more of that, and I think that's good. For TV, sometimes it works, like Fleabag. I'm assuming I trust you, and I trust Phoebe.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it doesn't work, like Game of Thrones.
You know, we weren't going to discuss Game of Thrones, but I will say, after seeing the season finale of season two of Killing Eve and what might be the series finale of Fleabag. I have to say, that's how you end things. You end things really well. She did it really well. And it's not that I don't think Game of Thrones didn't do it well. I just think that there was a couple things lacking.
They didn't do it well. The more I think about that last episode, this is a little bit of a tangent, I'll just say this. The more that I think, because I went in wanting to love it, I just thought the second to last episode, it was like, okay, that was a little dip. But I watched it, and my general feeling was, oh, lackluster. There was no excitement. But then, as I started thinking about it, there were so many ridiculous plot holes and just things that didn't make sense. So, for me, mm-hmm. it was a combination of lackluster, kind of boring, plot holes, and, the Dothraki didn't kill Jon Snow as soon as they found out what he did, but instead kept him prisoner. That makes no sense. Mm-hmm. And there was something like that in every scene, practically. Yeah. So the fact that it was lackluster and kind of illogical is just really sad. Listen, I still think it was a fun series to watch. It has so many amazing moments. I think they just dropped the ball at the 10-yard line.
Oh, sports reference sports for the analogy. Win. Yes.
In your face. So maybe they should have hired Phoebe Waller-Bridge to...
Oh, bringing it back. It would have been definitely funnier. Right. Yeah. Well, all hail Phoebe Waller-Bridge. We'll get back to her now. Thank you for two incredible series. And I cannot wait for season three of Killing Eve. That, I know, is coming back.
First of her name, writer of stories, Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Yes. All right. Well, we have so much more ahead. When we return, we are going to sit down and speak with the costume designer of the brand new season of She's Gotta Have It from Spike Lee and The Big Sell. It's all coming up after this short message.
Hey, James.
Hey, Neke. What we doing, girl?
We are inviting the awesome listeners of Maximum Fun to join us at Minority Corner.
Ooh, fun.
But you know how we go on Tangent City.
We're the joint mayors.
We're not going to do that, okay?
Soup's focus.
Okay, so Minority Corner is where you can all come and get your pop culture take.
Plus, social commentary, news, and TV movie reactions like Avengers Endgame.
No spoilers here.
Ooh, snap.
Sometimes we dig into the vaults and we review and recap those movies you missed.
Looking at you, Halle Berry's Kidnapped.
I love how she always gets 1,000%.
Like Beyonce.
Did you see Homecoming on Netflix?
She was burning it down like the Mother of Dragons.
Have you seen the latest Game of Thrones?
So good. Only thing missing?
More black people.
What you think about Mayor Pete?
Wait a minute, James!
We went on a tangent.
Yes.
Ah well. Join us every Friday for more tangents.
On Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Inside Pop.
We are excited to bring you another interview with a pop culture creator. Recently, Amita had the chance to speak with costume designer Marcy Rogers. Marcy has created wonderful wardrobes for Spike Lee's highly acclaimed Black Klansman, as well as season one and the brand new season of She's Gotta Have It.
So excited to have Marcy Rogers with us. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
I want to dive right in and just get a little bit of information about how you got started in costume design. What was your inspiration? How did you get your start? And where did you go to school?
Well, short story is I tell people how I entered into the profession of costume design is God. Because if I give you pretty much the 2-minute spiel as to how I went from working at Howard University School of Law as an assistant director of admissions at the premier Black law school, which is my alma mater, Howard University, I transformed from that to working with a Broadway costume designer and former professor at Howard University, Reggie Ray, who was my mentor before he passed. I was his last assistant, and he pretty much, I believe that he passed the baton to me in regards to him knowing that I wanted to be a costume designer, but not really understanding what that meant because my background was business and my profession at the time was law, education. Well, it really wasn't law, it was education and administration. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got involved. Shortly after working with Reggie, I visited University of Maryland, which was a random school visit. And mind you, I worked in education. So, like, to do school visits, you pretty much have to sign up for it. And I randomly walked into University of Maryland, the Clarice Smith Performing Arts Center, and met my second mentor, who I call my visual artist mentor. She pretty much taught me how to be an artist, Helen Huang, who knew Reggie. And after my campus tour, I hand wrote a card, because I still believe in that. And I would say maybe a week or so later, she emailed me and told me she had an assistantship available. And again, me working in education, I was just kind of like, oh, cool. You know, I had been saying it out loud, like, I'm going to be a costume designer. And at the time, I'm like, I'm going to Yale. I had no theater training.
Wow.
Nothing. I was just like, I'm doing it. And this is just what it's going to be. But that's not what God wanted, or had planned, I should say. So I get this email from Helen 2 weeks later about an assistantship that's available. Come to find out, it was me being accepted to University of Maryland on a full scholarship, tuition paid, to attend University of Maryland's MFA program in costume design. I started that January.
That's amazing.
And I graduated 2.5 years later, top of my class. I graduated with a job because shortly before my graduation, Mr. Lee offered me the job to design season one of She's Gotta Have It. I was commencement speaker of my class, and I was invited to be on the board of trustees at University of Maryland's theater department, theater and dance department.
Wow.
But those who knew me prior to all this, and they will say, and I'm actually thankful that, you know, some of them have, they constantly remind me at the right time that I always would say I wanted to be a costume designer. So really what I did was I was speaking it into existence.
Mm.
And when I was working, to back up a bit, when I was working at Howard University, I went to study abroad at Central St. Martin's for like 2 weeks. I just took vacation and went. And during that time, I was reading The Alchemist. I read The Alchemist the entire time I was there. And I knew, and anybody who's read The Alchemist, that after I finished the book, that my life would never be the same. So when I turned back to the States, and that's when I dove into working with Reggie Ray, who was designing a Broadway play, Hall, if you can hear me, fast forward to how I connected with Spike. Spike was he was in the audience of the musical, Hall, if you can hear me, and I worked up enough nerve to say hi and introduce myself to him. And he basically asked me why I was there, and I told him my mentor had designed the show, and I was, at the time, I kind of knew what a PA meant, but like not really. So I was like, I'm a PA. And he was just kind of like, well, that's not what I asked you. Why are you here? You know, he was kind of like keeping me on my toes.
Yeah.
And he asked me, did I know who Ruth Carter was? I told him yes. And he put me in contact with Ruth shortly thereafter. And right after that, I went to meet, and I guess you can say, in a way, shadow Anne Roth.
Wow.
So that happened all in kind of like one summer. And then after that, I worked with Paul Tazewell on a commercial with Spike. So all of this really happened within like 12 months, I would say, maybe shorter. So that's all of this is happening.
Unbelievable.
As I'm like trying to figure out kind of how to be just living this moment. But just really, it really wasn't even me living in the moment. It was me like, and I do want to say this, and I hope it doesn't fall on deaf ears, me living through the moment of hard work and sacrifice, because that's really what it was. And when I said it out loud, and I would say it out loud that I wanted to be a costume designer, the universe married that with my prayer to God. And so I knew at some point I had to sacrifice a social life to really get what it was I needed to get out of my process. So then when I graduated from University of Maryland, I'm kind of bouncing around, but literally this happened within like 12 months. That's when I started to design season one of She's Gotta Have It.
Wow. Wow. That is an incredible year. My goodness.
Yeah.
And imagine if you didn't have the nerve to talk to Spike Lee. I mean, that in itself was just
one thing I learned at University of Maryland, but I learned it early on at Howard University in the School of Business, is, you know, you really don't know what it means for somebody to tell you no, unless they tell you no, right? So like, you can start off by introducing yourself and exchanging energy, but I think the idea, right, is that a person like Spike has a lot of people coming up to him asking mm-hmm. him for something or not, you know. I'm not with him like that, but I mean, I'm just saying, you know, because he's Spike.
Yep.
But I was vulnerable in that moment, and I really didn't, and honestly, I didn't even really want anything out of it. I just was just like, if he tells me he doesn't want to talk to me, then he doesn't want to talk to me, you know. That's just what it is. I didn't go in it with any expectation or of yeah. him saying, you know, or for any celebrity for that matter. Like, I really introduced myself and said, hi, I just watched School Days. And then that's how Ruth Carter came up, you know, like, and as I watch School Days to this very moment, I see it from different layers. You know, at the time when I was pledging or being initiated, I should say, I saw it from that lens, you know. But then while I was in grad school, I was looking at it just from like sacrifice from that right. lens. And then when I watch it, I'm looking at it from all of the lenses, me, custom design, the story and all of that. So that's really what it was. I mean, I still would have been proud enough to go tell my father hours later, I just met Spike, or Spike was in the room.
Right.
Because I wasn't there for Spike. I was there to celebrate Reggie.
Yeah.
And he happened to be there and be a part of that moment. Unfortunately, me not knowing that 6 months after, Reggie would pass. You know, he died. So it was kind of divine.
I've seen a lot of your credits, obviously, before we decided to speak, and you have this really incredible combination of film work, television work, and theater production. And I would love to know how you approach each of the different mediums and the demands of those.
Well, all three across the board, you know, you have to start off with research, 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 particularly mm-hmm. if it's a period piece. But even contemporary, because I recently had an interview with someone and they were asking me, how do I approach my research for She's Gotta Have It? And I do actually heavy research for She's Gotta Have It visually, mm-hmm. Because I have to present that to Mr. Lee and also to Netflix. So I yeah. have like a wardrobe Bible of research, if you will, for myself that I just put together. And honestly, it's kind of like my walking, mood board, give or take. Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Cause it's portable, you know, when you know, in a production office, you can put everything on the wall. So this is going to sound really weird, but I feel like when I put pictures on the wall, I feel like that to me kind of guides my intuitive senses, where when I'm not in my office to see these photos, I can either go back to them in a binder, or it just comes to me because I've laid eyes on that at some point. So I kind of have it in my memory. So that's what I do. For theater, there's a process where it's a bit different. You go from having a conversation with the director to pretty much fittings. You go from fittings to everything going to stage, and I'm fast-tracking here. Everything goes to stage for tech, and tech is pretty much a time where the costume designer, the production designer or set designer, the mm-hmm. lighting designer, and sometimes projection designer, we're all in the room. And every day after rehearsal during tech, we go through notes. And the director will say, well, you know, that purple dress that she's wearing, let's tweak it a bit and put like, I don't know. And half the time, sometimes directors don't really know how to say it. So you kind of have to learn how to speak their language or just be ahead of them. She's like, oh, I want this purple dress, but I want it to have something, like some type of texture. And if you're paying attention to the set and you're paying attention to the lighting design, then you want to put something that's going to add to the picture that we're all painting together, right? Mm-hmm. For film and TV, it's the same process, but you go in with the director first. You have an interview. Preliminary research is important. I mean, I can kind of segue into BlacKkKlansman, where I had a Bible, like I had a huge binder full of research that I showed Mr. Lee just so he can see where my mind was going and what I can see what he liked and what he didn't like. And then you go into fittings, honestly, because you don't have that much time. For theater, sometimes you can have 6 months, you can have 4 months. For film, you only have sometimes 6 to 8 weeks. The train is going. The moment you start prep, the train is like gearing up to go out of station, as I tell my crew.
Right.
So by the sixth week, it's like, to me, it's already gone. Like, the train is not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing for TV, but TV is a little different because depending on how it's shot, it's either shot in episodic order or it's cross shot, meaning you're shooting several episodes at once.
Right.
So you're prepping for that and you constantly have to always, not so much be ahead of the game, but like particularly for background research, that's really important because sometimes, you know, you may have a character or two characters on within the scene, but the background is what makes it feel like a period piece or a contemporary piece. Like let's just say for season two, for She's Gotta Have It, the Prince Black Party.
Mm-hmm.
The background makes you understand that you're at a Prince Black Party, right? Everybody's in purple, and the cast all have on nuances of Prince homage or shirts in purple. Mm-hmm. Some of them did, some of them. Actually, I believe everybody had on purple except Jamie.
Mm-hmm.
And Jamie, Cheryl, Opal, Greer, and his girlfriend, they all had their rendition of a purple.
Right.
But they all kind of live in the world of the Prince Black Party that was being created, you know, and nature helped that because it was in the middle of a area we use that actually Spike actually has his Black Party there every year.
Right.
So that's my process. You have to be very open-minded. I cast a wide net with research and then I try to narrow it down because you can get a lot of photos that I learned working with Helen. You know, she would say you can have 1,000 photos, but you don't have to show a director 1,000 photos. Just learn how to sift through all of those photos so you can kind of sell your pitch and sell your story.
Mm-hmm.
And even so they can understand your aesthetic. I'm working on a project now, and one of the executive producers early on when I was interviewing, he said, I can tell the way you think. And I said, why? And he said, because of how your research is organized.
Hmm.
You know, and I was like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, you know?
Yeah, of course. Of course. And for She's Gotta Have It, it's such a love letter to Brooklyn. And Spike Lee's intention is there to really discuss, obviously, the gentrification of Brooklyn, and but then also just celebrate it in so many ways. And I know that you would taken that into account with your approach to styling everybody in the show and locally sourcing everything, right?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned it. I was just telling a high school friend who's in town. We walked to Dance Africa, which BAM is actually putting on for the community, if you will. And this time last year, Spike and I walked through Dance Africa and hand-selected some items, you know, that stuck out to him that he wanted some of the actors and actresses to wear. But it also gave me the opportunity to see what, and I say that in quotations, Brooklyn nights look like, right? You still have the ones that are native to Brooklyn, but then you have those that have come in and kind of adapted the Brooklyn style or infused our style with what that means. So it was exciting to visit this, it was exciting to visit this festival a year later, and I'm like, wow, I'm like, wow, I see these colors, I see everything, and that was pretty much my jumping off point. And strangely enough, when Mr. Lee did a extras casting, I asked him, could I attend, because he wants you to come as is, like, you know, or in character, mm-hmm. or what you would think. And I literally sat in a corner and watched. From the time we started the casting to the end, I watched everybody who wanted to be a part of it as background casting, because he has open calls, what they wore. And I incorporated that.
That's really smart.
And anybody who stood out to me, I would, like, literally, other than him taking photos for his own, for casting wise, I would take photos of anything. I was like, wow, that stood out to me, or that stood out to me. That was interesting how she put it together, you know, or this could go with that. So, yeah.
And so you took, you know, you went into those castings, and you also, like, talk to me about the process of finding the wardrobes. You know, the thing that I love about the show is that each of the characters in the show is so completely defined. They're super complex. You know who they are mostly because of how they dress, right? Like, there's quirky and carefree Mars, who has his own, he like marches to the beat of his own drum, has his own style. You know, it's Nola, who's determined and sexy and smart. You know, Jamie, who's, you know, consummate professional. You know, Greer is like the statuesque model. Clorinda, like super business minded. You perfectly dress each one of them, and but they also have their own sense of fashion. Like, it's not cookie cutter, right? From the way that I view them in this show. So like creating each of those looks, and then also, like we had said, like you've used, you know, Brooklyn artists and designers to do that. And which I think is so very holistic and smart to do that as well. So it feels, again, like these are characters in Brooklyn living there right now.
So, well, season one, because like I said earlier, I'm not from Brooklyn. I was like adamant about going to Brooklyn stores and Brooklyn boutiques and getting in the mindset of where would Nola dress? Nola knows she can't go to Saks Fifth Avenue because obviously, you know, the black dress came about, which I designed for that show, for that episode, season one. But, love, you know, she's at a thrift store and she knows she's not supposed to buy this. Fast forward to season two. She's buying a camera, you know, and she says it like, there's my rent check, you know. So for Nola, I still kept that in mind. Where would Nola, really pretty much for all of them, where would Nola shop? I reached out to, there's a look that Nola's wearing. It's like a purple gradient or ombre bikini shirt. Or, I'm sorry, bralette. There was this young lady on Instagram that kind of popped up in my feed. She had recently graduated from FIT. And I reached out to her and I said, can you make this for me? And she was literally, she did it within like a week.
Wow.
I mean, and it, you know, I was just like, wow. Like, she was like, I love the show. And didn't really want anything from it. I think she just, and I'm thankful that she just believed in my vision, you know? Where else did I shop for Nola? Some of what Nola is wearing, I've designed myself, particularly the Martha's Vineyard look with the neon green skirt, the like yellow tint neon green skirt. She has on a orange cutoff crop top, which is now like, I think is going to be iconic, if you will. I designed that myself. You know, I was like, these are moments for Nola that I feel like she shouldn't share with anyone in a store, you know. So that was my process with that. And she does have some things that I definitely made for her. I obviously made the Puerto Rico, the white outfit that she's wearing at the beach. Funny enough, Clorinda, Zara, and I want to say this out loud, Zara has been my savior when it comes to Clorinda.
Because, that makes so much sense.
Because she's very, she's still chic, but she's, like you said, professional, you know?
So she's always put together.
I just, literally sometimes, because of, like I was saying early on, film moves a little bit faster, or a TV. I would literally go into Zara and just like storm Zara. It's funny, my crew would call me like the Zara Mafia, because I would buy, like I would see things and be like, that's perfect. But how I shop for characters is I'm in the mind, like I literally become that person in a way. Like I tell people, you know, yes, I'm a costume designer, but I'm pretty much the character first in a way, because I have to dress them. So I have to make sure that if this person was personified, how would they really dress? So Zara is definitely my go-to for Clorinda. Dries Van Noten is shoes certified, because they still have that chicness to her, to them, but they're professional. There's a boutique in Brooklyn, Bird, that I frequent a lot for Clorinda. Mars, funny enough, a lot of his clothes I actually bought and remixed. Because Spike was like, okay, we can do the Jordan thing, as you see,
right,
really hard in season one. but let's like remix it. He was like, Marcy, be creative. He said, be creative, be creative. You know, you can only put Mars in so many Jordan shirts till it's like,
yeah,
all right. You know, so a lot of what you see from Mars, I remixed it. I would get shirts with like 23 or vintage shirts, cut them up and like collage them on top of what he's wearing. Definitely infuse the bright colors for him still. And obviously he still wears his Jordans.
Of course.
Off-white Nike. I want to say this on record. Thank you for sending him the Jordans and all that. Greer. I designed Greer's entire costume. His entire wardrobe for season 2.
Really?
I had a conversation with the actor. He told me what he wanted. And I knew it was something that I was not going to be able to find in stores like I wanted it to look. And also without it not looking cheap. So I literally went to Move Fabrics downtown, bought up a plethora of fabric, and I worked with my tailor and I gave him my vision. So really and honestly, Greer is wearing Marcy Rogers designs, if you ask me. Because it's his entire wardrobe is what I designed.
Custom suits by Marcy Rogers.
Yes. And then Jamie is wearing a lot of Paul Smith because we, as you can see, I've given him a pop of color. So every time you see Jamie now, you're like, whoa. And I shop sometimes for him in Harlem. So in answer to your question is literally like, where can I go shopping? Where would this person shop? Like Nola's father. I know he would shop on Flatbush in Brooklyn. Nola's mother goes to Martinique's Dream, which is in Brooklyn. You know, she still has that bohemian flow to her, but she's still matriarch. She still looks like an older version. She is what Nola will become 20 years from now or 30 years from now.
Right. Wow. And now to translate, now I see like how you get into the mind of each character, and it makes sense. Like you just want to wake up and be like, what will Greer wear today? What is Clorinda wearing today? You need to be in that headspace. That makes a lot of sense. So then taking all of that work that you do to figure out what they're wearing and all that stuff. So, you know, and that research. So when you're on set, what is a typical day like?
It depends on the show. A typical day is fittings. It could be fittings for cast and, our, you know, they're coming into town. So I have to fit them. It could be, and it is, shopping. Also, on set sometimes, having to answer questions. You know, there may be a actor, actress, even though we may have gone through this process of fittings, right? My cast, they may have a question as to why I chose something. Or even, like, sometimes it's a nuance, like, these earrings, you know? Like, they'll say, well, I don't want to wear these earrings. And this is why. And I'll say, okay, fine. And if I have a reason why they should wear the earrings, I'll just say, well, this is what it is. And so at that point, I don't see it as a challenge. I see it more as a collaboration. Let's figure out a way where this everybody's happy. Because I still want you to wear earrings, you know, but it doesn't have to be the dangly ones.
Do you also collaborate with like hair and makeup as well when you put together the looks and when you're in those fittings and all those things? And how, what is that relationship like?
More so hair. LaWanda, who's the key hairstylist on She's Gotta Have It, she and I talk and had a talk early on about Nola and her braids.
I was going to ask about that.
She and I talked about it, and it was, you know, she bounced that idea off of me. I'm sure she bounced it off with Spike. Spike was down for it. So, you know, incorporating that and knowing that the braids were going to be a big part of it, I think it, together, whether or not we meant to do it, it enhanced our design. You know, like, they kind of go hand in hand now, like, you know, Nola now with the braids and the color and the pop and the, she looks like a Nubian queen, you know? So yes, we do. And actually for Klansmen, to back up, I talked, LaWanda was actually the key on Klansmen, and Martha did the makeup. We did have conversations. When I would have fitting photos or fittings, I would send my fitting photos to them early on as much as possible so that they can kind of curate what it was, more so for the background. Because the looks were already distinct for Ron Stallworth, for Patrice, for Odetta. So we knew what those were because we kind of had pictures to work off of. But yeah, I try to, if I can, get in talks with hair and makeup sooner than later.
Mm-hmm. And then where does Spike come in once you've gotten those looks created?
Spike is a part of it in the beginning.
Okay, got it. And then when it comes to filming, he's like, I've seen it, it's good. I'm all about just filming.
Yes and no. I think for Klansmen, it is what it is, right? So like I said this earlier, for me, I would revert back to my research. And I'm an 80s baby. So every time I would send something to set, it was almost like a quiz or a test because he lived through the 70s. So if something necessarily didn't get kicked back, so to speak, then it was correct. It was factually correct. It was historically correct. One thing I can say I appreciate about Spike is he understands for me that the devils are in the details, meaning, you know, for Patrice, she had on all black, but it was texture to her black, so she didn't look flat.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that is all brings in the picture. For She's Gotta Have It, big BG days, Spike is there. And he literally is standing outside or wherever we are. I mean, last season it was warm, so he would line up all the girls first. It would be me and Spike standing next to each other. And some things, if it just stood out to him, he would say, please change it. Thankfully, it was one or two. You know, it could just be anything. Because, you know, when you have large BG days, they just fall. 300 people. Background. Correct. Yeah. They could just fall through the cracks. And that's pretty much it. I think we've gotten to the point where Spike knows my aesthetic. And he and I talk. If I have a question, I will ask him early on. Like, hey, how do you feel about this? Excuse me, which is what I asked him for Ron Starworth's denim suit in Klansman. I actually came up with the idea. I was like, hey, how do you feel about him wearing like a denim walking suit to juxtapose him to the organization? And he was like, go for it. And it actually worked out because that's an iconic look now. Like, I get asked all the time, how did you come up with the idea with the denim suit for John David? And it was really like a beautiful mistake, almost.
Wow. That's so interesting. And I love the collaboration with all of these different departments to really get these looks to the amazing like finished product that you put together. I have to ask, is there anything next now that She's Gotta Have It season two is done? What's next for you? What's your next project that you can discuss?
Right now I'm working on a biopic. I'm going to leave a little bit of suspense. I'm working on a biopic for a rap group that is, well, actually got their start here in New York.
Wow.
And I'm honored to be a part of this project. And I know it's going to continue to push the conversation or further the conversation about culture and how rap contributes to fashion and culture, particularly in New York. And I'm excited to see the final project. And it will appear on Hulu in September, from what I've been told.
That's great. And you have another project with Steven Soderbergh?
Yes, Steven Soderbergh, who's like a dream to work with. High Flying Bird actually released on Netflix, I want to say a month or so ago. That was awesome. And working with Andre Holland was amazing. There were a few more younger actors and actresses. It was amazing. That was a really good show.
That's wonderful. And how did that process go working on that type of show versus something like She's Gotta Have It?
My process is no different from any director, be it Steven, Mr. Soderbergh, Spike, Mr. Lee, or Liz Garbus, which I just actually wrapped a movie with her. She's the director from What's Happened to Miss Simone. I presented research, you know, and I learned this actually from Spike. I put together my research book. I get a red Sharpie. And I tell whomever the director is, please X, like put a big X through what you don't like. Because it's like a hot iron for me, right? Like, oh, I won't go that way, you know? And I've learned how to read my own research through training. So, and I think directors appreciate that because they know they won't see that on set. So I did that with Mr. Soderbergh. And he also allowed me or afforded me the opportunities to collaborate with the characters or the actors. So they would kind of give me input of what they may think they could wear. You know, it could even be like silhouette or shoes.
Ah, that's interesting. If you had your pick of one thing that you could do moving forward, film, TV, or theater, and you could only do one, which one would it be?
I don't know if I can answer that because I'll tell you why. I've done theater and I plan to still do theater. I've done TV and I've done a movie. One thing I said when I was in grad school is that I always wanted to design an opera. And in November, I'm designing the first Black opera in Toronto. It's called Tre Monisha. So it's on record, dated before Porgy and Bess. And I found it quite interesting because I always said it like, I want to design an opera. I want to design an opera. And this opportunity came to me.
That's amazing.
So that's why I say it's hard for me because I'm a student of my craft and I like to learn. So if the project is worth it and it allow me to push myself and learn something and I can walk away proud, be it contemporary or period, that's a project I want to be a part of. And it'll help somebody, you know, it's a conversation piece, so to speak. So yeah, I'm designing an opera and then maybe a musical.
That's amazing. That is so, that's incredible. I really enjoy just hearing your passion for your work and all of the opportunities that you've really manifested for yourself and have been able to really excel at and grow from and build upon. So thank you so, so much for taking the time to speak with me. And if there's any way that anybody could find you on social media or direct them to your website or anything so they can learn more about you, please share with us now.
You can find me on Instagram. My name on Instagram is Marcia Lago. It's Marci, my first name, MarciAlagio, or Alagio. And my website is marci-rogers.com.
Great. Thank you again. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
Amita, I'm so glad that we had the chance to have a costume designer, and especially someone as accomplished as Marci. I think, you know, we're all about exploring everything that goes into creating the TV shows and films we love. And I think hearing about costume and all the thought that goes into it really tells us a lot about the process.
It really does. You know, it likens back to how we got to find out a little bit more of the process from Warren Ellen Young, who was a production designer. It's just putting all the pieces of the puzzle of creating a scripted film or TV show and how much thought and research and work goes into creating some of the shows and films that we love.
I often hear actors talk about the costumes really help them find the character. So, you know, the costume designer is obviously appreciated by the actors, by the directors, producers, and the viewer. So what a treat to hear from her.
And that was my most favorite part when she says that she gets in the mind of the character. She has to be the character in order to figure out how the character is going to dress.
That's great. Method costume designing. I love it.
Yes, yeah.
All right, well, we will be back after this very short message with The Big Sell.
If you like MaximumFun.org podcasts, chances are you are an enthusiastic consumer of good media.
Which is why we're here to tell you about the Outlier Show on MaximumFun.org. The one that just doesn't fit.
The Greatest Generation is a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast, and that MaximumFun.org is probably a little bit embarrassed to call one of its shows.
And that, more than anything, should inspire you to subscribe and download The Greatest Generation. What is this thing?
Why is it here?
Who listens?
All of these answers can be found if you subscribe to The Greatest Generation using your podcatcher or by going to MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Inside Pop.
And now it's time for our favorite final segment, The Big Sell. If you don't know, now you know. The Big Sell is the segment at the end of every episode where we sell something that we're enjoying in pop culture to the other, and they return the following episode and discuss what they liked or disliked about it and give it a little review and rating.
Last week, I big sold Amita the Netflix series Special, a series focused on the life of a gay millennial living in LA who happens to have cerebral palsy. I loved the humor of it, and I thought there were some things about the show that I thought you might find interesting, Amita, and that's why I big sold it to you, and I'm very curious to hear what you thought of it.
Well, amongst my weekend of watching Fleabag and Killing Eve and all these other things, I also watched Special, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, so much so, because each episode was 15 minutes, yes, I watched the whole thing.
Excellent.
And it's a tribute to really strong writing and, you know, really likable, relatable characters that the creator and writer Ryan O'Connell put together for this series. I really loved his character, just not, you know, trying to find his way and also not being able to share his truth, mm-hmm, about having cerebral palsy, and also the added storyline of his mother. Yeah. There's one episode that I really enjoyed, and it was really telling the story about the mother and how much she gives of herself and how much she helps her own mother, how she is just always there for her son and all his needs. And it just broke my heart, mm-hmm, but in the best way. And kudos to Jessica Hecht, who you all may know as, I believe, Susan on Friends.
Right. That's right.
Is it Carol or Susan? Right. Carol's the wife.
Oh, my God. That's right.
Yeah. It's basically Ross's ex-wife's girlfriend.
Yeah.
That becomes her wife.
Yeah.
But it was really nice to see her, and really loved her character in the show. And of course, you definitely want to know my opinion of Kim. His,
you know me so well.
Fabulous, fabulous, amazing, endearing, kind of becoming best friend,
yeah,
on the show, who's his coworker at Egg Woke, best fake
ridiculous
title of,
I love
a
it
company ever. And how she really just like lays down the law, but always comes with sweetness but truth and encouragement, and really asks the main character to really reveal himself and pushes him, and I love that about her.
Another brown face on TV. Do you think is she Indian?
Oh, yes, her name is Poonam Patel, so yes, she's one of my peeps.
Work.
Another Patel.
Great,
go on,
great.
Girl.
Love it. Love it, love it, love it. And it's interesting, like, it's kind of cool. It's, like being Indian is not part of any plot line, right? It's like she's, there's so many other things going on with her, but she's, you know, she's proud of who she is. I love her character. I love their relationship.
Yes.
And, you know, I love that she has a life. She's not there just serving him and just being his BFF. You know, she's got her own desires and dreams. And
Yeah. And I love him navigating being gay and exploring just his emotions and his needs and wants.
Mm-hmm,
and really being honest in that space, you know.
Yeah.
I really, really... really, thank you so much.
Oh,
for
good!
This with me.
I'm so glad. Yeah. I'm so glad. Yeah, the episode that focuses on the mother, I think, is just beautifully written and acted.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a scene. It's just like stuff I didn't think about before. But there is this really amazing scene. Is it, maybe it's the third episode where he goes to a sex worker because he, you know, like being a gay man with cerebral palsy, he had trouble putting himself out there, which I can understand. And it's, I don't know what I was expecting, but I'm going to say it's really one of the most beautiful sex scenes I've ever seen on TV. It was so touching and warm.
Very warm and so tender. And I feel like, I don't know the actor's name, but he, what the way that they wrote his character and how he knew,
mm-hmm,
he had cerebral palsy without Ryan having to tell him, and just... He knew it and revealed it to him later on, and really just was there for him and didn't look at it as just like a transaction.
Right.
And I thought that was just really well done.
Oh, I'm so glad you liked it. It's so good, yeah. Everyone. I'm special on Netflix. Even Sean Johnson, Mr. Anti-Binge, I binged it. I mean, I was done with that show in 2 days. So,
yeah.
Great. So what's your rating of Special?
I really did love it so much and was thoroughly amused, and it warmed my heart in some ways too. I will give this a rare 4 stars.
What sure. is yes. happening?
Yes. Oh my thank you. God. Yes. Round of applause.
4 stars. We need sirens and lights. Are we in the club?
Yes. Yes, we are. The club for
oh, gosh.
4 star big sell.
I am literally flushed right now. It's not just because I came back from the beach, but
no,
4 stars does something to me. I really, we should end the episode here, but there's another part of the big sell, and that's when now Amita big sells something to me.
Yes, I am really excited, even though it is only the end of May. I'm super excited for the annual event that Sean and I continually go to, which is Afropunk. Mm-hmm. And the lineup is fantastic, like it is every year. And we always find new artists on the roster. And one of the artists that I have found that is going to be attending this year's Afropunk is an artist named Masego. Have you heard of Masego?
I have not heard of Masego.
I hope I'm saying it right. Masego, Masego. I'm going to go with Masego. Masego is a saxophone player, a singer, rapper. According to his Spotify bio, he's also a comedian and a DJ. He has this really awesome R&B, hip-hop, dance vibe. But, you know, the through line is saxophone, which we hear here and there okay. in hip-hop and R&B. Mm-hmm. But I love what he does with that instrument. And I think that he has a really cool vibe. And I wanted to big sell him to you.
Exciting. We were just talking about the need to get into some of the smaller artists so that we can hop, skip, and jump from stage to stage. So
yes.
I love that. You're giving me a jump start.
Yes, yes, yes.
Thank you.
It's going to be the summer of all of these artists for Afropunk.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. Oh, we should create a playlist of all the new Afropunk artists we discover.
Oh, my God. Yes, yes, yeah. yes.
Cool. So are you going to sell me his album? Or
I'm just selling you him as a
him,
being.
Just a person.
Yeah, I will sell you his album. Make sure I get the name right. It's called Lady Lady, and it's his recent album from 2018.
Oh, great. Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. I will definitely listen to it because that's my job. But I'm excited to listen to it. Thank
Good.
You so much, Masego. And also try to pronounce his name correctly. I can't make
I'm
any promises.
Find out. I'll look into it and make sure for next episode we get it right.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for that. I look forward to jumping in and checking him out and hopefully loving him.
Yay. Well, that is it for us this week. As always, stay in touch with us on Twitter and Instagram. At Pop Insiders is our handle. Head over to Facebook or visit our official website at insidepoppodcast.com and hit that subscribe button so you can listen to us every other week.
Like clockwork. You can also find us on MaximumFun.org. If you didn't know, it's a podcast network collecting amazing podcasts like ours. There's no time for humility. Amazing podcasts like Inside Pop and other podcasts dedicated to comedy and culture.
And as you know, the summer is upon us. We are going to inhale all the pop culture we can and share it with you guys. So don't miss an episode. We will be here every other Wednesday for your pop culture obsessions.
Thanks for listening.
Later that day, I got to thinking about relationships. There are those that you open up to something new and exotic, those that are old and familiar, those that bring up lots of questions, those that bring you somewhere unexpected, those that bring you far from where you started, and those that bring you back. But the most exciting, challenging, and significant relationship of all is the one that you have with yourself. And if you find someone to love the you you love, well, that's just fabulous.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.
Carrie Bradshaw, Sex in the City.
Oh, I thought it was Michael Corleone, Godfather.
I mean, yeah, when he's thinking about his new and exotic, you know, relationships, in between all of the murdering. Yeah.
Is that the sense. Is that the movie or the series?
The series.
Oh, so good, that show.
I know. And then that bedazzled phone rings and it's big. Yeah.
Love it.